Черт, я даже начинаю.
Well, that's discussed a lot. It's kind of a bring up thing, and there's certain disagreement among parents about it. And it's not, I don't think it's the main thing, but as far as impact on other people, yeah, if you burn down some polluting chemical factory or something, people are going to be out of work, but the damage is being done on the constant basis by that thing continuing to operate as well. And we do know that people are, I mean, just, I'm thinking of, there was a riot, an anarchist riot in Eugene, before Seattle, like 19 years ago. And there was a huge, it was just so enormous, the whole outcry. And maybe, as with your mother, I mean, and there was a lot of damage done. Not a lot, but you know, some over about a 4-hour period of raging around. That was kind of amazing. Anyway, it seems like in the absence of a real of accessibility to what some of us are thinking and why we justify making some assault of that nature, again, not the only thing, that's for sure, but it's going to be some outrage defensiveness and anger and you want to destroy my pickup or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, that's no one's going to be targets. But I think to some degree you sort of have to pass through that. There's going to be some inconvenience. I mean, the whole system is all tied together. We're tied into it too. It isn't going to be disrupted with no unpleasantness. I mean, with no, you know, it's going to be, I hope not severe, not to the point of dying over, but you know, this is a death machine that's operating non-stop, and it has to be stopped. You know, so it would be, I think probably everybody would agree, we could imagine an ideal way where things just somehow go on smoothly without a hitch, and we just seamlessly go into a much better world, but I don't know exactly how. You know, I do think, though, one, this is not a clear answer or analogy, maybe, but the what happened in France in May of 1968, and rather suddenly in that spring, it became, in May, a huge occupations movement, a general strike, 10 million people, and the police were rapidly, completely bypassed, even the army. French army was powerless because that many people, what are they going to do? Take a tank after people or something? The whole population, practically, not the whole population, but a giant percentage of the world's population. And there was almost no violence because it was just a huge, it was kind of, I don't think anyone died. There was no violence in that sense. There was damage to property, that's for sure. Lots of burned up cars and cars and parents. But when you consider the magnitude of that, and it didn't turn over the whole society, it stopped after a few weeks and then went back to the normal lousy everyday life. But I don't know, just saying, no one knows how much it's going to cost to stop the machine. And some of those things will happen and they'll be upsetting people. I'm not sure the way around it. One way around it is to try our best to explain why we feel it's necessary to do certain things. To some people, they never heard that before, and then they can deal with it.
And maybe the way to present it to your mom is to ask her whether she supports legal violence. I mean, that's much more brutal, and statistically much more coherent with the whole script of civilization. Like, for example, does she drive a car? So, you know, what does that mean in terms of wars? Does she drink coffee? What does that mean in terms of the violence that, you know, people in Africa and in South America experience from being forced to work for miserable wages in order to feed this machine at gunpoint? I mean, they don't come necessarily with guns to tell them to grow coffee, but everybody knows if they refuse, it will be like Cuba, it will be like Iraq. Saddam Hussein has no right to refuse a machine. If he refuses, we bomb the whole thing. So that's much more violent, and it's written within the script like every children's book, every newspaper article for adults that we're exposed to contains this legal violence that by its legality becomes invisible. So what becomes visible is the hooligan anarchists like rioting and burning cool cars. But, you know, the whole machine, like Harry Potter. Like Harry Potter is murder. It's all about murder. Who has the right to kill? For some reason, what's his name? The evil guy. What? Voldemort? Yeah, exactly. He does exactly the same thing that Harry Potter does. But he's bad. But Harry Potter is good. Because Harry Potter obeys the good reason of violence and oppression. So that's invisible. Violence, because that's, but if you look at it, that's what you, like, that's what kids are reading and identifying with, is that killing for this guy is good, but killing for the other guy is bad. Well, if all killing is bad, how about we question the whole premise of these relations? And I want to talk to your mom, talk about that.
Another real brief one is how sometimes it's kind of ironic how illegal things can become sanctified. Maybe some of you have seen the best film about the Seattle anti-WTO rioting, Breaking the Spell. There's a little quick clip in there where Lewis, the filmmaker, is talking to somebody who's saying, oh, I think property damage is just out of, it's wrong. It's wrong. And he says, what do you think about the Boston Tea Party? And the person says, yes, and without realizing, well, no, you are in favor of destroying property, but in that respect. Or to make a more severe example, John Brown, who led the attack at Harper's Ferry in 1859, people were killed, he was one. And he's a saint of American history. In fact, within a few years, he became a saint. He went from horrible psychopath, the killer, to John Brown's body, you know, the song. So, depends, in that case, who are we going to say is good and bad, like you said. I've missed it. If there is, I just haven't had gotten that out of very long. I mean, you can jiggle a word forever until it kind of falls apart, and you can say whatever you want that it means. But you know, I mean, that whole project seems to me it started with a certain intention to be subversive, and it never was. I don't, or maybe I'm wrong. I mean, what how? You must have a view that sees it as somehow contributing to destabilizing society or something.
My trouble with Derrida is that being an academic, I mean, he depends on just chewing and chewing and chewing those words. Being French, they're like so megalomaniac about their French language that it becomes kind of, I'm sorry to use the word masturbation, you know, on the same thing. He does, like, his critique, it's like, well, so what? Like, he gets his paycheck. He wouldn't want the whole thing to fall off the next day. He depends on it. He's domesticated in that way. I found recently a text, but I just started reading it before coming here, so I haven't finished it. But for once, I found something interesting, at least at the beginning, what Derrida is saying, and that's the animal that therefore I am. And in that, I finally find like some, because, you know, in all that civilisation langue française, like, I just saw like this academic chewing, like, I didn't see Derrida. And finally I see Derrida when he's talking to his cat, and he's ashamed standing naked in front of his cat. I, for once, I found that interesting, like, he's beginning to really view himself as, is it I think, therefore I am, or is it the animal that therefore I am? And in French, I am, je suis, has, like, suivre, has two meanings, really interesting. And he plays on that. Être, like, I am, being, and suivre, je suis, like, I am, and je suis, I follow. And he plays on that. Do I follow, like, the animal that therefore I follow, the animal that therefore I am? And that, I'm beginning to see, like, him suddenly appearing in some other skin, maybe catly fur. That's interesting, but I don't know where he's, like, I can't vouch, like, I don't know where he's going with that yet. But otherwise, it's like always chewing on the same thing. It's the same, like, with most academics, and that's why I actually admire John, is that he did not go into academia, and myself, I'm battling with this, like, how much do I think I'll be able to really have a dialogue with my students, or fall into just parasiting of this whole system and end up losing myself within the system. So I don't know, like academics, I find really rarely that they manage to honestly look at themselves and say honestly what they're doing. Because ultimately, you end up justifying, even unwittingly, you end up kind of justifying the hand that feeds you and get domesticated. I hope not. I don't know if that responds. Yes? Well, for me, it's not like the writings of, you know, all these postmodernists that I dismiss. I dismiss all categories because they're essentializing. Like by saying, by grouping together a bunch of authors like Wittgenstein, Derrida, Gadamer, you know, the whole Salman Rushdie, Edward Said, by grouping them all together, like saying, okay, this is postmodernism. Julie Kristeva, these are postmodernists. Before that, they were the modernists. Before that, they were the pre-modernists. We're essentializing them and actually ignoring the fact that some more than others, you know, do spot, you know, certain things and can offer, you know, interesting critiques. But academia likes to tame. So, like, for example, if you're going to read Salman Rushdie as a postmodernist, okay, it's tame, it's an academic who's postmodernizing Islam, criticizing Islam, and that's good. Okay, he's in. But what gets missed, and when I point out, like, I'm not a terrible, like, I haven't read that much of Salman Rushdie, but from what I've read, I wasn't terribly impressed. But he does have interesting points. And these points do lead, like, if taken, like, to their end, logical end, they do lead to anarchy. But if you mention that to academics, postmodernists, it's like, you're out of here. Like, don't even talk to me. You don't have a PhD, or you're getting your PhD, fail. Okay, so, like, the category itself of postmodernists, that's what I have trouble with. I could read, like I said, you know, some of the critique of Derrida and these postmodernists, I find, especially the fact that in the West, they come from academics, and academics end up justifying the machine, ultimately, because they do. Like, they feed each other on each other. So I would trust more somebody coming from radical critique of academia and of the whole, like, all the spectrum of the... But, yes, you know, everybody is, everybody can chip in, you know, even the homeless in the metro, but nobody listens to them. So again, like, who are the postmodernists? The postmodernists are the ones who are accepted by the publishing business. Who runs the publishing business? Okay, supposedly it's a few white guys and white girls, and they take in minorities for, you know, for the quotas and political correction thing. But still, you know, the mindset is what is, and they run like the show for capitalist interests. So ultimately, what gets published, what gets critiqued, is by the same gang, and it serves the same interests. So then it kind of it wastes itself on itself, you know. So that's my problem with these.
Yeah, and yeah, you're right. I think generalizing too is that's such a vague thing. In fact, it's, as you may know, that's denied. I mean, most of the postmodern people say they're not postmodern. And if you ask for a definition of postmodernism, that is kind of, in a way, the point of postmodernism. I mean, I remember when I was writing about this a little bit in the 90s, and at one point I was calling up some academics and saying, what is postmodernism? And they'd say, well, I thought maybe you knew. In other words, you know, that's kind of the game. It's, and you can't have a lot of people writing theory for decades without finding something useful. I mean, you know, of course, Gustavo, many people, you can find insights, but it is possible to kind of generalize. I mean, I've tried to write about it at least once specifically, but it would take a lot of sorting out, but I have never found any postmodern thinkers who aren't totally civilized, who don't completely support domestication, the symbolic order, technology especially. So, and for example, and I just mentioned a book, Time, Technology, and the Conversations of Modernity by Lorenzo Simpson. I think it's a wonderful book. Not Bart Simpson, Lorenzo Simpson. And the main point of that book is that fundamentally postmodernism is about technology. It's about the embrace of technology and the refusal to raise any questions about it. This guy's very academic. He can skip over various chapters, but it's, I found that pretty persuasive. Metro and Bias, he makes that point pretty well.
Yes, absolutely. Because, well, since I look at the basis of the relations or the knowledge of the self and the world that is implicit, or particularly implicit, like what's taken for granted in the book. In the authors constructing a world of creatures who interact with each other, how do they interact, why do they interact in a certain way, then it's very interesting. You see that Winnie the Pooh, and I picked him on purpose because there's no overt violence in Winnie the Pooh, but the way he's portrayed by Disney animation, well, you know, he's greedy, he's, you know, whatever, but there's no war. Like, say, Harry Potter, it's easy to say, okay, well, it is about violence, it's about killing. Winnie the Pooh looks like, oh, just a greedy old bear, and some other, like, a depressed Eeyore, the smart owl, they're all funny because they're all in the imaginary world of this child. And this child is growing up, and it's all innocent, but that's like the world he's reproducing, that he sees around. So it could be read that way. But what's where the child starts in that book and where the child ends shows us what the author takes for normal. Like, what are the relations? And actually, the relations, well, it starts with the fact that Winnie the Pooh is named. There's Winnie, a swan. Oh, and it starts with the zoo. So Christopher Robin goes to the zoo. And when you go to the zoo, you go straight to the animal you love most. You go from way in, you proceed to way out. In the middle, you stop most, and at the cage of the animal you love most. You stand there, observe the animal you love most, and then you go on. And from that zoo, he decided there was one swan who was named Pooh, and he didn't need that name anymore, so he took the name and gave it to the bear. Okay, what's wrong with that? Well, everything. The only time that Alan Alexander Mill uses the word love is by going to a cage of an animal you love and looking at it. If that is not pornography, then, like, that's what you're setting up your kids by telling them how cute the animal you love most. You have no relationship with that animal. The animal exists for your gaze in a cage. And that is called love. Everything else in that book is based on this relationship. And the boy has the right to take the name and give it to whoever. And that's who he becomes. And that's violent. Because to put somebody in a cage, well, nobody's going to go in a cage willingly. And you have to drag them, you have to shoot them, you have to tie them, you have to domesticate, you have to starve them, you have to deny them access to food, to freedom, for their own purpose, to reproduction, to having children, to dreams, to hopes, to seeing the sky, to running around, to doing nothing. All that is denied because you exist for the gaze of the observer. Simple as that. Then there are other books that you mentioned, the anarcho-primitivist or environmental primitivist anarchist world. And that's a much more complex. It consists of 9 books written by Tove Jansson. She was a Swedish minority Finn. So she was born in Finland. And she died just a couple of years ago, old age. She was an artist. A very interesting background. She was a child of artists. And a lot of her childhood, her father was a sculptor, her mom an illustrator. They spent on a small island in the Baltic. And her father, whenever the storm would come, he would take the kids, two boys, and I think she was the middle child. He would take them on a boat, the whole family, and go out to face the storm. And so, like, because the storm is nature, is beauty, and cosmos is harmony. It's chaos and harmony. And that, like, she grew up accepting, and people said, of course, crazy, like, killing your kids and fun. But she obviously survived to old age in spite of all the storms. And she created a world in which creatures interacted, like, the family was open, like, whoever, first of all, they moved away from civilization, and, like, the book, even, it's called The Moomin Trolls, they start by moving away from civilization into the promised land, and that's wilderness. And in that wilderness, it's very interesting. They go through the book. The first book was written after what's his name, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Willy Wonka and yeah, the Chocolate Factory. And so in Roald Dahl's Chocolate Factory, like that's the ideal world where you bring in slaves, you know, those exactly. They work indoors, they're happy because they were saved from that horrible wilderness. They're preying on their, like, he saved them so he could lock them up in this factory, making sugar, making sweets, and it's like the best thing that can happen. And the winner of the competition shall become the capitalist, the industrialist, the poison maker, the enslaver that Wonka is. Okay, in this book, in the first, the prelude to all the other, and it's very simple, it's like 45 pages. The family that escapes civilization goes, and I don't think it's a coincidence, through exactly the same condition. Like, they go into a mountain and there's a guy who has a sugar factory. And they, like, he's making all this, like, everything is made of sugar. It's, like, magical. Like, artificial land. It's within, they have to enter this mountain. And within this mountain, they could hide from war, from everything, from all this scary world. And eat sweets, like, all their life, all their lives. And so they're, like, and Moomin Mama is with two kids. So they go into there, and, like, they get lost, like, oh, sweet, 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 sweet. And then after a few days, it's like, the light is like, it's never off. It's like, it's electric, it's artificial, it's too, like, they start, like, getting really nervous. They don't sleep enough. All the sugar, like, they're getting really, actually, they get diarrhea. And they are just like, to save their lives, they have to get out of this world. And they have to go in the wilderness. And when they go in the wilderness, and they build a home, it is not a stable home, like, it's a home that everyone is welcome to use. Whether they're in it, whether when in winter they're asleep, other creatures come in and use it. They wake up, you know, the winter creatures go to sleep. Sometimes they coincide and meet. The main, it seems like Tove Jansson's favorite character is a nomad, a gatherer. And is Snufkin, who hates things, and the only times, you know, somebody offered him to get new pants, they were secondhand pants, and he looked at them and he said, oh, they're too new, I can't have them. And he's always moving and living in a tent. And the relationships there are, and people find it actually, I talk to the people, it's beautiful stories. And people tell me, especially like in North America, that it's so strange, we don't know what to make of it. It's like, she has so much imagination, but it's not clear what she wants. Because the implications are really, yeah, are scary if you're domesticated. The implications is like, wow, you know, you could just be out in the world. So, you know, these are the dynamics that, yeah, I get. Is that what you wanted to
do? I guess I just had two questions in that brief statement about like violence and property destruction. My partner and I went to Bolivia and Peru a little earlier. Well, you know, 2000 was a water war. People shut down an entire city, like where it was taking, you know, the highways like, under control. And by people I'm talking about, and you know, they're civilized. They watch TV and like they make up. I mean, and they are mostly. Nonetheless, I mean, a few grandmas were just walking around with, you know, burning things and escaping over the streets. And then you go to Argentina, and I was really interested there. That was a water war in Bolivia. And in Argentina, it was really interesting. You know, the middle class of money got froze. And, you know, if you asked me for their ideas about property destruction, I'm sure they would come to the next that, but it took like a few hours. They were, you know, banging pots. The next thing you know, middle-class mothers are just taking like screwdrivers to bank credit. And like, so I think people with like ELF and ALF and probably like people in Bolivia and Argentina, they understood the depth of the problem as like ELF and ALF more than some of us. Or, and that's like you said, there are different cultures. They understand like what it means to kill off the earth, to kill off species. You know, they've really somehow connected that with the park, you know, so much of the problem that there became, you know, like it wasn't really a moral problem. It's this is what has to be done and all these people now you have to make it to you know. Yeah. Anyway, the other two questions I had, and I mean I've been really critiqued of primitivism. Some of the elders are hardcore resistors, haven't signed the thing, and, you know, like, discard their family if they ever worked for the coal company. But then other ones, it's, like, kind of hard, I mean, to eat and have food for most of, like, 200 of their sheep that are killed and stolen, so they can't live. I mean, they're being exterminated, basically. So it's, like, what is our role? And, like, you know, I'm talking to the son who works for the coal company who destroyed the land that they belong to, like, you know, and I feel like, out of privilege is like weird to me saying, wow, you shouldn't work for the coal company, like what about your heritage, like you're destroying the earth, like, I don't know, I feel like it comes, it can be kind of complicated with.
Well, I thought she presented that so eloquently last night, and of course that's the bench inside, and we see the contradictions of her, that she's caught from the choices to the bad. Of course, but my sympathies would be with the elders who are those people who are trying to reconnect with the traditional life ways that don't depend on either of those choices. I mean, that's easy to say, of course, you know, the four corners, or that's what they're left in a good place that where you know, maybe it's given to pretty much absent a lot of resources, so it's even worse. You know, once you get to that state, you know, and that other one, I don't know much about that situation, but because I'm in Bolivia, I was thinking about an article that we published in Green Anarchy by Jesus Sepulveda, Chilean, and another part of the Bolivian thing is Morales, who's indigenous, but as Jesus points out, boy, he's indigenous, but so what? He's a career politician. I mean, that's the way the system fronts people off all over the map. You know, you get somebody, get black mayors in American cities, and then you can incinerate, move people. If you had a white mayor, there would probably be an uprising. But since you've got a token black guy in there, you can kill these people and get away with it. Maybe that's a little too crude to put, but that's, you know, a good point. And Sepulveda wrote this piece called The Luluization of South America, and he was talking about how just Lula but Morales and Chavez, you know, he pointed out that the key thing in breaking the resistance of the indigenous people that have been resisting an empire for 500 years, in the case it's actually down there, is to co-opt them. It's, in other words, you have to have the left to do that. The right can't do that. That hasn't worked. So now you get the more insidious thing. And when I see a lot of people being so much in support of these leftist regimes, I think they miss an extremely important point there. Not the only point, by the way. They're also, it seems like, it looks like they're the best industrializers. They're pushing it faster and farther than the New York Times, the right-wing regimes have been able to do. So where's the upside? You know, there's very little upside at all. Anyway, that's just something I was just thinking about on the topic, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a evil, but just like on a smaller scale, like most of these workers, you know, have lost their jobs, and then actually a bunch of, you know, all the clothes that the church's gear or whatever gives them comes to the border, and so other people are selling.
Yourself, like what you do then?
No, we were just basically learning.
Like
from
you
them,
personally.
Learning from them and,
okay.
And writing, getting their word out.
And how do you?
An indie media.
How do you live? Like, what do you live on? Do you get a grant or you don't like work with them for food? Like, you know? Because, okay, where I'm coming from actually, either. Yesterday beat me to that and talked about in the session of Palestine and I share that that sentiment with people from like this almost like the heart of the disease going on all these initiatives all these countries to save them and work with them, point the way. I was having a debate with an used to be an old friend of mine, and I don't know if she wants to be my friend anymore. Like, she's all hip on going and saving the bonobos in Africa. Like, that's it. Like, her deal is like, we're going, like, there's bonobos living, and there's a village, like, well, it's almost like a town there, and we want to go and initiate, like, awareness about how to save those bonobos. So I'm thinking, I'm asking her, so what did you do with your bonobos to show them by example? Like, how are you going to teach them? Like, isn't that ironic that they are the ones who have the bonobos and you are the one who doesn't even have, like, an indigenous culture to boast of? How many wild animals do you have here in Maryland? Like what, skunks, raccoons? Is that what you're going to go and teach them, how to save the bonobos like you saved the skunks and the raccoons? Have you saved the skunks and the raccoons? Like, what do you have to teach? Like, isn't that ironic that you are from the heart of the disease going there? And it's like, okay, I don't know your situation. Yeah, but that situation is that the amount of money they need just like for one person, because like the village is so far away, like this a special boat with so much gas, like it turns out like it costs almost $3,000 for two persons in a boat just to go on that river to reach the bonobos. I'm like thinking, well, just by going there, how many bonobos have you killed together with the Africans who live near these bonobos? Who will end up going and killing these bonobos just because you're going and teaching them. So far they haven't. Like, so it's really ironic how and what, like, the purpose. And sometimes we really have goodwill. Like, I know this person, she was my friend. Like, she really has good intentions. But it's almost like the doctor who, for his livelihood or her livelihood, ends up depending on everyone being sick. So if the if everybody became healthy, the doctor wouldn't have a livelihood. So the doctor becomes a hyena or a parasite, like feeding off the disease. It's the same with this development thing. It's like the development people end up being dependent on the misery and the suffering that are going to go and get blankets or sell cheap food or cheap clothes or donate Nike. They get a living out of it. But it perpetuates, like, I have no solutions. And again, to respond to the question on violence, it would be, and we talked about that earlier with John, like, cancer has to be operated at a certain point. You have to cut it out. If the world is so infested, like, how are we going to cut it out? How are we going to have a surgical operation to heal this world? Like, how are we going to heal it? So that's like, that's what I'm battling with. I mean, I don't have an answer, and I'm not saying like you shouldn't go and interact in Bolivia or Africa or India or wherever. But just, you know, be like, you know, question the dynamic of that relationship. And again, like yesterday, in that session on Palestine, it's a woman, I don't know where Eileen is from, but, you know, with all her obviously coiffured hairstyle and, you know, makeup, she goes to Palestine, she comes back and she writes this. Maybe they're very nice books, I have no idea, maybe she's a great person. But the fact that it's like, obviously what takes to just cater for her and her books and for her voice to have the authority to speak on her experience in that horrible Palestine. Whereas, like, how about you could have gotten like 50 children out of there, and they could have come here and talk, like, just for what it, for the resources that it took you to get your voice out, to come and tell us what it's like to live in Palestine, really, and grow up and survive in Palestine. And to say, like, you know, in any situation. So that's my problem with these initiatives. Oh my god. You go. That's a killer question.
Well, isn't it better to say animal companions rather than domesticated?
Well,
yeah. No, we just got a dog from the animal shelter about 2 weeks ago.
That's why I let it dog,
and I know we're going to go through this agony like we did with the dog. Yeah, that's I had a friend who used to just rail about that. And pets, that's just so unhealthy and so neurotic. But it's a bit of a, yeah, you're right, but I love my dog or my cat. But I don't know. It's one of those things I guess.
Okay.
You certainly get something out of it. You have pets?
So, okay. Okay, it's confession time. I was really, like, okay, I had very interesting experience growing up. So, like, born in this mega city, Moscow, as some of my most impressionable moments were in this small village surrounded by forest in the south of the Moscow region. With my grandparents having a farm, and that's when I decided before I was even five that I wasn't going to eat animals. And it was really difficult because I was being forced to. Then moving to Africa. In Africa at first, my first experience in Africa was, or at least what I remember, was going in the Darfur region. And at the time, it was nothing of what it is today. And maybe inadvertently, my parents contributed to that situation. My father was a geologist, and he was working for a United Nations project, looking for petroleum, gold, diamonds, the whole galore. But for me, it was a wonderful experience because it was the savannah. We were in a tent, 8 months. I was a kid. My sister was, we were the only kids. And we really, like, it was wilderness, like real wilderness. There were different tribes around, gazelles, giraffes, lions, like, you know, just you would see them going past the camp, you know, to the camp was set so as, you know, wouldn't be on the way where they would go to their water hole. And it was an incredible experience of harmony, of darkness during the night, of complete light and sun and heat during the day, animals. And yes, my desire was always like, oh, what a cute baby ostrich. So the geologists go hunting, they kill the mother, they bring me the baby, and like, oh, baby ostrich runs away, nobody can find it. They're like, okay, we'll get you a monkey or a gazelle. Actually, with the monkey, it was a very interesting experience because they brought the monkey, the whole tribe followed the cars to the camp, and they were throwing stones and nuts, asking for the baby back. And it was, I remember, the royal blue macaque, I think, was like really beautiful. And I was like maybe 6 years old at the time. And actually, it was also an awareness on our relationship with animals because my mom told me that the people of the monkey came claiming for the baby. I know you want a pet, but the baby wants to go with its paws. And that was like my decision. And I remember, like, I was capable of identifying, because my mother was like, think of it, like, you're a bit, like, if somebody takes you away from me, I would do the same, I'll go insane. And I remember, I want the baby. It was, I wanted to have, but then I realized I don't have the power. I cannot allow myself to have the power to keep this baby. And that was like a really revealing experience. And we let the baby go and jumped off and they took off away with the baby. It taught me a lot about solidarity, compassion that the animals have for each other. That we people not necessarily, like, you look at adoption agencies, they would never tell adoptive parents, well, think about it, like, why are those parents abandoning their children to you? Maybe instead of paying this for adoption, you could just give the money for them to raise their own kids. It's like, you know, we take babies as pets, we take pets as pets, we take everyone as pets if we cannot eat them. On empathy, actually, I planned to read it in my session, but I didn't have a chance. So the quote from Goethe in Peter Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, Critique of Theory of Evolution, the importance of the mutual aid factor, that's from Kropotkin talking about the German philosopher Goethe. If it generally could only be demonstrated, the importance of the mutual aid factor, did not escape the naturalist genius in Goethe. When Eckermann, and he was a zoologist, told once to Goethe, it was in 1827, that two little wren fledglings, which had run away from him, were found by him next day in the nest of Robin Redbreast, which fed the little ones. So these are two different species of birds, I guess. And the Robin Redbreast fed the little ones together with their own youngsters. Goethe grew quite excited about this fact. He saw in it a confirmation of his pantheistic views. And that's the connection of empathy to spirituality, to intelligence, to living in this world. A quote from Goethe: "If it be true that this feeding of a stranger goes through all nature as something having the character of a general law, then many an enigma would be solved." And how I would connect it to having pets is precisely by, if anybody comes to you, you receive them, but you treat them with respect. And if they don't want to, you have no right to incarcerate them and starve them and punish them. So that's my idea on pets. I mean, animals make friends with each other. But what we do with them, the whole, like I heard people say, oh, it's like you didn't castrate your cats? That's torture. Like, look at all the, like, it's a kitten machine. They get horny every now and then. It's torture. Like, you should, and I think, like, how do you know, like, it's your purpose of what, it's torture to deny them their own meaning, their own realization of their meaning. All we can offer is, you're welcome to come to my home, and I'll share with you. And you're welcome to leave whenever and wherever you want. So, long answer to your question.
Well, I was just reading a pretty much brand new article that was available last week, some kind of mega report on 42 different studies of DNA. It's some newer methods of approaching the question of the initial population boom. And it's been widely accepted that domestication causes this abnormal boom, but there are people, there's always a kind of counter-revolution, if you will, that tries to say, oh no, it started with hunter-gatherers. Maybe it did, but I don't think it did. But anyway, the summary of this whole thing was that somehow through this kind of elaborate DNA type testing from remains, the determination was that none of it started with hunter-gatherers. In every single case, it was agricultural communities that threw the whole thing up. So it's just kind of a leap, but it could be that the implication is you remove the domestication, you remove the main thrust of the imbalance of population. And even if that were true, I mean, it doesn't show you how fast that would happen, or even if that is the main mechanism, it's a tough one. And that, as to whether birth control is a technology, it's certainly a technology in the modern sense, I would say, but you could also say, as people have written about, there was a birth control early on, quite possibly when women were people to be more in touch with their bodies in a direct way and didn't need external stuff so much for, or what we know a little more about is the could say the natural birth control of gather-hunter women, where you couldn't have babies so often. I forget what the years, what the gap is, maybe, because it's not, if you're not in a sedentary, domesticated life world, the years between births is much longer. So there are fewer children to start with in that sense. So you could say that's birth control, but it's not. I wouldn't say it's a technology. But, you know, devices and birth technology is more obviously a technology.
Yeah, well, I share this opinion, and the fact that also with the whole idea in domestication that you could own land and produce and own and produce, having children became also an investment. So in a way, it became, if you started going into the world with property orientation, property set of mind, then an inheritance comes with that too, because in the gathered society, like, if you don't own, you don't inherit. So you don't have vested interest in having a lot of people capturing a lot of land and trees and animals and plants and buildings and real estate and whatever. So then you're easy on in your relationships. There's nothing you really need to control your offspring and to have more of offspring. So, I mean, that also comes with the set of mind that in domestication you would tend just, and it's actually very interesting, like, if you look at the classes that own and the classes that are owned. So it's the dispossessed who reproduce more, because, like, this is what their investment is. This is what is going, the more offspring, the more you can send them to work, the more you can get back, and maybe some of them even might manage to acquire something. And in the classes where it's inheritance, it becomes not very profitable to have a lot of offspring, because then you have to divide all you have accumulated already. So it's better to concentrate them in the hands that. So, but so in a way, it becomes what strikes the eye is that it's all those poor people are just reproducing, they're like rats, and what do we do with them? They're a problem, like India, China, this and that. But the cause of the problem is the possession and inheritance of all of these resources, human resources included, by the few. And once that dynamic is shuffled and destroyed, maybe we would be more in tune with our harmony and our world, and there wouldn't be any. And I believe that could be solved really, like, the population, overpopulation problem would be solved without violence really fast, because, so, you know, some of the critique of anarcho-primitivism is like, oh my god, you want the destruction of millions of people. Like, what do we do with the overpopulation? Do we starve them? Do we kill them all? You don't have to kill anybody else. If everybody just realized we stop participating, we stop viewing our children, the world, as resources, everybody would have one child. You aim at one child, some will not have, some will have two maybe. In how many generations will there be a decrease, like drastic decrease in population? Just like change the set of mind, change your knowledge that is based on this violence and this you know, and it's solvable. But the problem is always, actually what Owari yesterday mentioned, is that the dispossessed have been dispossessed for so long, and they've been dreaming of these possessions for so long. How do we even have the right to go to a rickshaw in India and tell him not to want? I would never be able to look a rickshaw in India in the eye and say, no, you should not want. Like, how do we solve that? That I don't know.
I think the food worker thing is pretty anti-domestication, as I read it, and there certainly are, there's a radicalization in the culture as well, along those lines, I think, but speaking of domestication, permaculture can also be kind of an elite gardening club. You know, you see that in Eugene, they're not grasping at to go and, you know, employ that as one of the things we'll need to have a real alternative to, you know, what we're hostage to now. But yeah, I think both of those things. Well, maybe, I don't know, I had a guess on that, but maybe all forms of cultivation. I'm not sure about that. But I've seen some changes in the literature and in some people's points of view and attitudes, say Kevin Tucker, who now seems to be he's much more sympathetic to horticulture, certain forms of horticulture, which are scarcely domesticated, you could say, you know, I think an easy example is this forest horticulture where you can't see, you couldn't find the garden if you didn't know how that's done. It isn't marked off in the usual sense of that. So, but there are people who, in fact, Kevin himself earlier wrote an article saying it's making the argument that it's better to jump over all these things right to the torch and instead of thinking we have to go through some stages of small-scale agriculture or horticulture or something and work our way back. But is that right that now he's more, just to use an example, somebody's written about this, he's not so hostile about that. Well, it's not real recent because he hasn't published his magazine. Yeah.
Well, you know, if we look at the diversity that exists, you know, for family arrangements in the wild, like all sorts of arrangements, single mothers, the penguins, it's the fathers who take care of the eggs before they hatch, lemurs, they have matriarchal, lemurs are the pre-primates, the proscenians. So they're like very close to their social organization, to humans. And they have like, even among them, they have very different organizations. It's, well, you know, whatever fits their needs. And it's not even like an essentialist thing that, okay, because they live in this forest, you know, then they're matriarchal because they live in that. I mean, I don't know how they decide on these dynamics, but there are nuclear families that are bond for life, and both parents provide for the child. There are matriarchal families where the female would, like, they live in a kind of sort of a commune, and the female would decide who is the best guy to have the offspring with, and they all raise kids together. they're the single mom version with some felines. Other felines, like the lions, they live in the pride, and the lioness is the one who provides for everybody, including the guy, the father, or, you know, the uncle. So you look in the wild, there's so many possibilities of organizing your relationships and of raising the kids. And it seems like, but the principle that directs all of these animals is cooperation and compassion for all the children. Like the example I read, and there's like so many examples of animals always responding to the pain of other, and particularly to abandoned children, even cross species, like even predators. If a predator, if a lioness is nursing and she finds another suckling, she will nurse that suckling too. So for humans, well, it's whatever you feel. Like I personally went for a monogamous and a nuclear family because I kind of knew that with my ideas and lifestyle, I could wait forever, you know, to find a commune, to find friends. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go for a monogamous lifestyle. I talked with my partner before we got married. Okay, getting serious, we're going to be getting serious. You know, children might come. How are we going to go about it? We discussed everything before, you know, getting into this. And then community came. For other people, it works the other way around. They first need the community, and then raise the kids. The most important is this, the kid grows protected, embraced, and loved by the people who are taking care of them closer, and by the world. And of course, you get loved by the world if you love the world. So it's a mutual thing. So how do we transmit that to the, like, that is the very difficult part, because we're all being touched by this disease of civilization. Every one of us is guilty of living and participating in this machine. How do we start healing? That is the question. We try our best, but where will it take? What do we leave to the future generations? I'm afraid to think. I don't know if that responds.
Well, Jared Diamond and many others have pointed out, it invariably happens. Civilizations invariably collapse. And I'm not sure, is that what you meant? Or, well, for us now in this civilization? Or? Well, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that there'll be a sudden dramatic collapse, and I can't think of the sources offhand, but it's in reading about how many people at large feel that it isn't a question of if, it's a question of when, how widespread that is. Not talking about theory, but people who are sensing this is crazy and fragile and it could just fall. You know, but it's also possible that it could sort of break down, but we'd still be under the same pressures, and it could just be a degraded form, but not completely go away, rather than just an all or nothing, which is, I mean, in other words, the psychology of it, it's always, you kind of look for the showdown, you know, here's going to be the breaking point, but it might not be that way. I mean, perhaps the author will be that way. Derek Jensen makes that the case pretty well, I think. The whole thing is going to come down because it's so interrelated, it just starts to, and then it would be virtually impossible to put it back up. And I'm not so sure about that. If people want to put it back up, I don't know why they wouldn't. In other words, to me, the bigger thing is, I think there's a chance that we could be the agents to bring them, and that that is the healing and the therapy, that we are the agents, we're not just waiting for it to collapse. Maybe that's a long shot. But if it just collapses, it doesn't break down the, it doesn't break down the social relations necessarily at all. Does that automatically erase racism and sexism? I don't know. But if you are, if you do the conscious dismantling with the, another vision in mind, if that somehow catches on enough to maybe make it a soft landing, if it's sometimes calm instead of just waiting for it all to, you know, because the other, you could say the Marxists have a similar vision. You want to extend the metaphor a little bit, waiting for the economic collapse. This latest recession, all kinds of Marxists just salivate, oh, this is the end, this is the final. Well, no, there's a recession around every 10 or 12 years, and it lasts about as long as this one is lasting. And then it doesn't, you know, it's probably be nice of it all. But, you know, again, not doing anything about it, really, but just hoping that it will all fall apart on itself to give us a gift of, that it's in ruins now. So that how we can all hold hands and do the wonderful world then, you know. You know, I just have some doubts about that. Who knows?
Sorry to interrupt, but we reached the end of the forum time, correctly running human time, but so Bobby Coggy is going to speak, he's supposed to speak about 5 minutes ago. We just pushed back like 4 o'clock. And so 10 minutes, and he may have known it's the coming up before. So if you guys find out loud, any comments or whatever, so we could wrap it up in the next few minutes.
Everybody speak together.
Well, I would have to admit that it's a kind of ideological question, the answer you give. I mean, my own, I don't know, predilection or whatever is to stress how fast nature can heal in case after case and dwell on that rather than the other part. But that's not very, you know, scientific. But, it, you know, you do see, you can see cases of that where it's surprising how it can come back.
So. Maybe the more difficult task is for us to do first. That's what we should be working
on. I guess maybe it sounds like you want to wrap it up. So we can, John Mailer is still around.
Is the next time.
Thank you. Thank you.